Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. This is the podcast with the unpopular opinion that progressive centre-left politics has a huge amount to offer the modern world. Over 13 million people in the UK now live below the poverty line, with an enormous rise in the number of people relying on food banks just to eat. So what role has the government's austerity cuts, and in particular, their attack on the welfare state, played in this? I'm Alison McGovern, and I'll be discussing that difficult question with Progress Deputy Director Stephanie Lloyd and Gary Lemon, Director of Policy, External Affairs and Research at the Trussell Trust. Today's subject is about food poverty, not the most cheerful of subjects, and in fact, something that on the Progressive Britain podcast we've been covering for quite a while. Our second ever podcast was my colleague Catherine McKinnell MP talking about the universal credit rollout and the problems it was causing, and unfortunately the government failed to listen to her. So today we have Gary Lemon from the Trussell Trust to talk to us about food poverty. Gary, thanks so much for joining us. Could you just tell us a little bit about food poverty specifically, and, you know, why is that different from just poverty in general? You know, the Trussell Trust have been going for a little while now trying to tackle this issue. Tell us what you've learned from trying to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually personally dislike the term food poverty. I think that really food poverty is just another symptom of poverty. Perhaps to give a little bit of background about the Trussell Trust and the sort of scale that we're working at the moment. So we have about 429 food banks right across the UK in all four nations. And last financial year, we distributed 1.3 million food supplies to people in crisis.
So that's 1.3 million individual kind of packages, if you like.
It's a measure of volume of food. So okay. It's one supply per person, but some people come back more than once. Well, they're not as many as you'd think. Our average is still less than two per person.
Per year?
Yes. Yeah. We're certainly talking about hundreds of thousands of men, women and children each year. And that was actually a 13% increase in demand on the year before.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's important to say as well, that I think about the model is that people can't just come to a Trussell Trust food bank and ask for food. They have to be referred by an expert. So that might be like a local authority, could be an MP surgery, GP surgery, very often a citizen's advice. So we know that everybody who's coming to a Trussell Trust food bank is in genuine financial need and is experiencing poverty, be that food poverty, be that, you know, we hear about sanitary poverty, so people who are unable to afford like sanitary products, toiletries, winter clothes, the whole lot.
Yeah, and I would say from the experience of my office as well, every time somebody comes in and they've got a problem and they're not able to feed themselves in whatever way, we always ask what's behind it, how can we help, you know, who can we call on your behalf to get to the root of this problem? And presumably all the other experts do similarly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, really important that people get all the help that is available to them out there. So one of the things that we try to do in our food banks is not just simply give out food in ever increasing numbers to people. We always try to signpost people to people, other organizations who can help. So, you know, people like Citizens Advice, for example, do a fantastic job. They're able to make sure that people can maximize the amount of benefits that they've got.
So to come on to benefits, let's get to the heart of this matter. What change in the benefit system is it that has exacerbated this problem such that you're getting year-on-year rises of the order of 13%?
Can I go back a bit and kind of work up to where we are today? Because this is a kind of a story which has been going on for a very long time. I won't go as far back as kind of Beveridge and the Five Giants and, you know, the whole reason why we came up with a welfare system in the first place. But something that's changed in the last, sort of since the 90s, actually, I read a really interesting paper by a Dr. Tom O'Grady from UCL. And what he's been doing is he's been looking at records of Hansard, analysing those. So that's essentially everything that is said in both houses of Parliament. And what he noticed was a change in language from politicians, particularly Labour politicians, actually. It's something which I think Tory politicians have been more traditionally talking about, which is there used to be this principle that in this country, there should be a universal lower living standard, which nobody should fall below. But what we saw in the 90s was a change in rhetoric, particularly from politicians, where we began to talk about people needing to deserve their benefits, needing to be split into those who deserved it and those who didn't.
Kind of going back to a sort of Victorian idea of deserving and non-deserving poor.
Yes.
Like the kind of, on the one hand, there'd be like the fallen, and on the other hand, there'd be the feckless, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's very bad. Like, I would never use that language, to be clear.
No, I've never accused you of doing
but,
so.
But there was that kind of, that idea of a split that somehow crept back into our politics, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And what this analysis said was that this change in rhetoric from politicians began to change the national narrative on benefits and on poverty. And if you look at something like the British Social Attitude Survey, which is this amazing annual survey which looks at British attitudes and all sorts of things, you'll see from the 90s, there was this quite constant drop-off in public support for the benefit system. So, you know, you ask questions like, what percentage of people do you think are cheating the benefit system? And we saw that go up and up and up until we reached 2010, when British support for the benefit system reached a real nadir. And obviously that was at the same point as we saw the coalition government come in, and we saw that first emergency budget in 2010, where we saw the first of tens of billions of pounds taken out of the welfare system. And I think the reason I wanted to go back to that sort of change in rhetoric is because that had widespread public support. At the time, I was working as a press officer for a homelessness charity. You know, I wrote the press release, which sort of pretended the doom that we were about to see in the future. And really, it was a bit like shouting into the wind. It had such wide support that people said, well, you know, we've had the financial crash. We need to tighten our belts. It seems completely logical. But unfortunately, fast forward to 2018, fast forward to today, and we are now beginning to really see the results of these tens of billions of pounds taken out of the welfare safety net.
So I suppose one of the things that you're saying there is that there was almost this kind of perfect storm, right? So you had kind of pre the 90s, I mean, you had the kind of Thatcher government and kind of, you know, decades of conservatives in control who we know as a party are not particularly polite often when it comes to people that are on benefits and the kind of rhetoric that sits around that. And obviously we know then, obviously in between the 90s and kind of 2010, for a large chunk of that, we obviously had a Labour government that did a lot to lift children out of poverty. But you're saying one of the things that we didn't do was tackle the kind of language around that and the kind of public perception of that, because obviously there was a lot that we did as a government to be able to alleviate lots of those pressures. But one of the things, obviously, from what I'm kind of getting is that what we didn't do was tackle that public perception enough in terms of that. Cut to 2010, you then get a Conservative government back in, hell-bent on the ideological change and therefore having the political will to do it. Is that the kind of situation that you're... Is that what you think the problem was?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to be too harsh on Labour. I think that those achievements which you talk about in the 90s are absolutely undeniable. And, you know, back then I was working for a homelessness charity. I was talking to outreach teams in London, and we were talking about eliminating rough sleeping in the capital.
Yeah.
You know, we had like the last 56 people with complex needs, and we were beginning to work out exactly what it is that we could do to tackle those issues. And, you know, I think that Labour policies back then were a huge part of that. But yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of the problems which we face today are underpinned by this, the public attitude towards poverty and towards benefits. There's actually some really interesting work which has been done by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation in collaboration with an organisation called Frameworks from the US, where they've it sounds sinister, but they've kind of experimented on 30,000 British people, trying to understand their attitude towards poverty and towards benefits. And what they found is that, yes, the British public has got a strong sense of fairness. And because of this rhetoric, that sense of fairness has kind of been turned away from this. We are a society which believes in a minimum standard for everyone and against people who are in poverty. Because, you know, I find it all the time, you know, I speak to people who I think are perfectly reasonable. And, you know, I'm always banging on about benefits. I'm very boring at parties. But even perfectly reasonable people...
You'd be great at my parties, Gary. I'll be honest.
Thank you. It's... you know, you'll start having this reasonable conversation, but then, you know, they'll start talking about, well, but then, you know, we've got Mrs. Miggins who lives opposite and I'm not sure if she works, you know, she seems to have a large television. You know, these are really prevalent, unhelpful attitudes. And the trouble with that is that rather than us taking a step back as a society, as a government, you know, as politicians, and having a look at the systemic reasons why people are ending up in poverty, we focus on the individual.
And just to come back to this systemic reasons why people are in poverty, I think whilst Osborne and Cameron were making their welfare cuts, one of their arguments was, well, the root cause of poverty isn't a lack of money. The root cause of poverty is like low educational achievement or being part of a troubled family. Remember that rhetoric?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe addiction in the family. I feel as though that we've been in this battle about what poverty really is for some time now. Is it a combination of all these other factors that mean that you find it difficult to hold on to money and spend it wisely? Or is it that you just don't have enough money to have the decent things that most people would expect as a basic minimum in life?
Yeah.
And therefore you end up having problems of other descriptions. And I tend to be one of those politicians, I suppose, on the left and a progressive that thinks that the root cause of poverty is not enough money. Mm. And therefore the answer to not enough money is the welfare state. The idea of the basic floor that everybody should stand on, as you mentioned before. Does the Trussell Trust have any evidence about that? Like, what do you think your kind of experience as an organisation demonstrates to us about what we should... What's the answer? How do we solve poverty?
That's something we'll work on. It's a big question, but we have been gathering quite a lot of evidence. So probably the most important piece of research that we've done in recent years, it was written up by an academic, so hasn't got the snappiest title. It's called Food Insecurity, Disability and Poverty.
You can give us a link and send us through the link and we'll put the link on the podcast so that people...
The most important piece of research, I can't remember the title at the moment.
Academics are academics. There's nothing you can do
They are who they are. Yeah.
Exactly. We can't change them.
But it is an absolutely fantastic piece of research. And what it does is that in order for us to be able to understand some of the systemic reasons why people end up in food banks, we asked about 500 households about what their circumstances were and then tried to draw conclusions from that. So what we found was that about 80% of households who were referred to our food banks were meant to be supported by working age benefits. About 15% were in some form of work, although often very insecure, part-time, low-paid, etc. We found that in the months before a household is referred to a food bank, the average household income is just £319.
Wow.
So, you know, if your listeners can try imagining running their household on that little money, it's no wonder that there's real poverty there.
Yeah. And like average weekly wages would be like closer to £500.
Indeed.
So like that's about right. Like 60% of median income. So this is people for whom they're not getting close to what is about the average wages in Britain.
Yeah, just to keep your heads above water. And I suppose it's hardly surprising that because people on such little money, it's a division
the joy of filming these things in Parliament.
Yeah, yeah. It's very atmospheric. Because these incomes were so low, we also asked people questions about, you know, what they could and couldn't afford in the year before they came to our food bank. So we found that fully half of people had gone without winter clothes, half had gone without heating or lighting at times, half had gone out without toiletries. We found that 80% were severely food insecure. So this is an international measure of food insecurity whereby we know that people have gone multiple days missing multiple meals, essentially. So real hunger. And probably the final thing to say, which came out of that report, which was really shocking, was fully half of the households who were referred to Trust food banks had someone in them with a disability, and three quarters with an illness. Single parents were massively overrepresented. So
it's really interesting, Gary, because basically when I hear you say that, disability, single parenthood, illness, beverage was trying to deal with these things.
Yeah.
So we're essentially back where we were in the 40s with the five giants are kind of back there staring at us in the face. And the drivers of the beverage system to tackle these things, that's where we should be now, right? We should be saying there are extra costs if you have kids, there are extra costs if you get sick. And that idea of smoothing your income, that's what the welfare state is for. And so the argument essentially, basically what we're saying is the same.
Yeah, it's not just about the welfare state, obviously. I mean, the other side of the equation is work, decent work that pays with decent hours. The current government is rightly proud of the fact that it's gotten so many people into work and we've got these, historic low levels of unemployment. But at the same time, if you look at levels of wages, we've had the longest, most severe stagnation in income since, I think I heard, the Napoleonic Wars. You've got more and more people dropping off the bottom and struggling to get by. So yes, work that pays, a welfare state that catches everybody.
And obviously, a Conservative Party conference, Theresa May announced that austerity is over, which,
Well,
I think we're all pretty dubious about in terms of the realities of this. But obviously that's had a huge impact, you were saying, in terms of 2010 onwards, in terms of the austerity agenda and the impact that's had. So,
and the clock is ticking. I mean, basically, it's now 2 weeks exactly till the budget. Mm. So we are on the rundown now. And I can only say that given the severity of this, that all MPs are facing, this will be the subject in the news, in Parliament, every day for the next 2 weeks until Philip Hammond gets up and says that £12 billion of welfare cuts is done. It's over. It's not happening. Mm-hmm. And unless that happens, we will keep going because people in Britain, they can't be asked to deal with this anymore.
Yeah.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So obviously, one of the things that's been in the headlines, we spoke about it very briefly at the beginning of the podcast in terms of universal credit and the changes in benefits in terms of, and that's happening. And obviously, one of the things you were saying is one of the biggest groups of people that were doing that, people that are on in-work benefits at the moment, kind of currently. So what would you say is the kind of impacts that universal credit and the rollout of that's having? And what's the kind of, why is it having such an enormous impact on people?
Yeah, so we've kind of talked about the bigger picture, but I think it is really important to home in on what is for us now the most pressing concern in terms of people ending up in poverty and needing food banks. And that is the rollout of universal credit. So it started being rolled out sort of 2016 time. And our food bank managers began getting in touch with us in central office saying, look, this is a disaster for people. We're seeing a big increase in demand. We're seeing issues with people during a 6-week wait. So we did some research where we began asking people who were supported by Universal Credit what their issues were. And we looked at some of the numbers as well. So I already mentioned that we had seen a 13% increase in demand across the board last year. What we found when we looked into it, though, was that in food banks, which had seen universal credit rollout for a year, that increase was 52%. So it's kind of
that is horrifying.
Yeah, a real sort of statistically significant increase in demand where universal credit was rolling out. And we were asking questions of people in terms of, you know, what's actually happening here. So we found that initial 6-week wait, which was shortened to 5, was having really immediate and severe consequences for people. You know, as you might well imagine, the way that the old benefits system was often paid was kind of a much more regularly, often fortnightly.
This is it, right? Like I live in London. I'm in a good job, as lots of people consider, right? You know, definitely earn more than the kind of average wage. Mm. I couldn't not have money for 6 weeks. Like I'm not even in that position now. And I'm like, you know, I'm, you know, 30 years old and in that situation, I can't even imagine what it would be like, particularly if you've got children or family or things like that, of the ability to have to wait for that. It's just not something that most people would be able to do.
Yeah. And yet that's how it was rolled out. So we as an organization and others made a lot of noise about that. Mm. And what we got in response from DWP at the last budget was extra money to be put into the system. So some things like housing benefit for some groups would be rolled on during that wait. And we also saw a big push on advances. So that's essentially a loan, really, where you could be lent the money to get you over that first 5-week wait as it is now. But then the issue with that is that you have to repay that from every subsequent.
You're constantly chasing yourself in terms of.
Yeah, exactly. And when universal credit was initially designed, of course they weren't like offering people like extra generous payments. It was already just there to cover the basics. So having money chopped off every month is causing people to struggle. And that's even leaving aside the fact that even Ian Duncan Smith is angry about how much money has been taken out of the system. You know, just yesterday he was talking about how he wants to see 2 billion extra put back into it. So we agree with IDS on that one.
Things you don't often think you'll
say. Yeah, I know. John Major as well. It's not just that weight, though. So we're also seeing real problems with, frankly, just shocking maladministration. So you keep hearing stories of lost documents. I spoke to a guy on Friday last week, and his wife's name had been entered without the S at the start of it. And it had caused them, through some kind of weird combination of circumstance, to be overpaid their universal credit every month, which they kept telling people about. And they were left with a £9,000 bill to repay. And those kind of issues of, as well, people who perhaps might be in work, who might be in low paid work, which was, you know, always the kind of the central selling point of universal credit, that it should always make work pay. We're finding that the system is struggling to keep up with fluctuating income and is leaving people constantly being overpaid and underpaid, which I think that issue really gets to something at the heart of universal credit for me, which again goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, we constantly hear about how universal credit, its core principle is to always make work pay. And what about the other core principle, which is to be able to give support to people who need it? You know, that too often seems to have been forgotten during the design and implementation of this benefit.
Mm. And one thing that I'd be really, really curious to know your opinion on is, obviously, over the last couple of weeks now, you know, universal credit has constantly been in the headlines in terms of how it works. As you say, we've had interventions from the likes of Ian Duncan Smith. We've had John Major come in terms of saying that he agrees with the principle of it and the concept of universal credit, and that the core idea of that is a very good thing. However, the fact that they've decimated so much funding from it is definitely something that he doesn't agree with and is calling for that to be put back in. And you've also got John McDonnell, who was saying, look, you know, we did always say that we would want to reform, but now we're at the point now where we think we've just got to kind of not just halt it, but maybe even scrap it. Where would the kind of Trustful Trust sit in terms of some of this benefit? Has it gone too far? Is it actually, you know, is it so poorly designed now in terms of not only just the rollout of that, but the kind of core concept of it, that you think it's something that needs totally reworking? Or is it something that just with an injection of cash would be better for the people that are on it?
Yeah, it's a good question and a tricky one. I think
not a big one there for you. I'm sure you'll manage.
I think one of the real tragedies about Universal Credit is that we'll never know whether it would have worked as designed, because so much money was taken out of it before it ever really had a chance.
Yeah.
I think if you are going to scrap it, then you'd better make sure that you've got something really decent in place to replace it. Because my worry would be, if it were just thrown in the bin, then it would be the people who need support from the benefit system the most who might suffer. So were that to happen, then there has to be something in place to replace it. I mean, the principle of making sure work always pays is a good one. Mm. You know, I mean...
And the kind of the idea of centralizing that benefit system, so it's, you know, one place that you go to apply for all of those. So obviously, whereas it used to have to be lots of different pots that you'd have to go to and different people you'd have to speak to.
Yeah.
Logically seems like a good one, but as you say, that kind of the delivery of that, and as you say, that other principle of looking after people that actually need it, you know, and having that safety net of that welfare system properly, obviously just doesn't quite seem to be there. And shocking by a system designed by Tories, really. Who'd have thought that's what they'd come up with?
I just wanted to ask one thing, Gary, which is really important to listeners of this podcast, which is that they will, you know, feel as outraged as I do listening to what you said. If people want to help the Trussell Trust, what is the number one thing that they can do to assist? Because what you know, volunteering or donating or whatever, it's not always obvious what the most helpful thing is. Is it literally go on your website now and make a donation? Is it call your local food bank, donate your time? Is it just take some food down to your local food bank or drop it off at a collection point? Which is the number one thing that people should be doing?
As things aren't immediately going to get any better, are probably going to get worse, I would ask everybody listening to find out where their local food bank is. Doesn't matter if it's Trussell Trust, independent or whatever. They will very often have specific asks about what it is that they need. Find out what it is that they need. Don't just give them beans. Often they've got a bean mountain. Some of them need beans sometimes, but usually not. Cash donations to food banks are obviously also really, really helpful. They've got lots of running costs that they need to cover. Go to the Trussell Trust website as well, trusselltrust.org. He says, nearly forgetting that as well. And you can find out what you can do to help us to volunteer and campaign nationally as well. And we're going to be doing more and more of that in the very near future.
So check out what your local food bank needs, number one. A second point is go onto your website, get your debit card out and give you some money.
Yes, indeed.
Fantastic. Yeah. Right. Well, that is great. We have our marching orders. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Every week we ask a political pub quiz question, which is then answered on Friday's show. So the question this week, and neither you or I wrote it, did we?
Absolutely not.
We would not lower ourselves to get involved with political pub quiz.
This is all Connor's handiwork.
The 1964 general election took place this very week, 54 years ago. And like in 2017, both the Tories and Labour won over 12 million votes. But how many seats were won by parties other than the main two?
Oh, do you know?
I haven't got a clue. But if you know, drop us an email at office@progressonline.org.uk and give us your answer. So we'll be back on Friday. Well, I will be back, but you'll be back, Steph.
Maybe. Depends if Connor likes me on Friday.
I'll be doing my surgery in the Wirral. You guys will be back on Friday. And we have been delighted to have Gary joining us today. In the meantime, please give us a rating and leave a review on iTunes. And don't forget to subscribe. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the Progressive Britain podcast. The music was When in the West by Blue Dot Sessions, licensed under Creative Commons. And many thanks to the brilliant Caroline Crampton, who produced this podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.